Welcome to Multilingual Montessori, a podcast where we discuss multilingualism, multiculturalism, and raising children from a Montessori perspective. I'm Gabrielle Kutkov, an AMI Montessori guide and TESOL instructor with a master's in child studies, and I'm the founder of Multilingual Montessori. You can find me on Instagram at multilingual.montessori and at multilingualmontessori.org. Today I'm speaking with Jasmine Williams, the Race and Equity Specialist at the National Center for Montessori in the Public Sector. Jazz provides race and equity guidance and education and delivers Montessori theory and practice instruction for the NCMPS Montessori Teacher Residency. Jazz has worked in bilingual Montessori programs for 12 years, including 8 years in a public program, as a classroom teacher, reading interventionist, Montessori coach, and academic director. Jazz has lived in, volunteered in, and traveled to 48 countries, most recently returning from 4 years in China. She is passionate about equitable and joyful Montessori education, and her dream is to bring free, socially justice-centered Montessori training and education to marginalized communities throughout the world. Jazz is currently earning a doctorate in education for social justice at the University of San Diego. I had a wonderful conversation with Jazz and learned so much from her. I think you will too. Jazz mentions a lot of resources in the episode, as well as organizations and people to follow. You can find links to everything in the show notes, which are linked in the episode description. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jazz.
My name is Jazz Williams. It is Jasmine, but I go by Jazz. I live on the Florida panhandle. I am that sliver of Florida that's in the central time zone. I live in Pensacola, and I work with the National Center for Montessori in the Public Sector. I am the Race and Equity Specialist. I also work as an instructor for our teacher residency program, and I'm a coach. If schools can't find one locally, I work with teachers virtually.
Awesome. I'm so excited to talk about all of these things with you. But to start out, let's go back in time and tell me about how you first learned about Montessori.
Ooh, that's a good story. I was living in Concepcion, Chile at the time. And this was like back in 2005. A coworker of mine at this particular school that I was working at, she was in an elementary classroom, perhaps first or second grade classroom. I used to go into her classroom often for language support. And one day I walked in, and she's got these sentences on the board, and then she's got this black triangle, and she's got a red circle, and she's got a small dark blue triangle, and she's got a smaller light blue triangle. And I'm like, what is this? And she explained, like, this is Montessori. And so she started talking to me about it. I'll cut forward, or fast forward rather, a few months, and she's like, I'm going back to my school in Santiago, and it's a Montessori school. You should come with me. And at that time, I had like no loyalties whatsoever. And I was like, let's do it. Went with her to Santiago, started working at this school. And I still didn't have a clue really what Montessori was. But I do remember going into classrooms and seeing the Pink Tower. And really, that set up the transition of me going into Montessori, because shortly thereafter, I moved back to the United States and saw an ad in the Washington City paper, because I'm from DC. And the ad said a knowledge of Montessori. And I had a knowledge of the word, and they didn't say like what knowledge meant. And so I applied, and then I became an assistant in a lower elementary classroom.
So how long were you doing that before you decided to get Montessori training?
I was an assistant for 1 year, and that 1 year really showed me what Montessori was and what Montessori was capable of, not only in terms of opening up children's understanding of what we consider to be academic subjects, but also just how children and adults were able to relate to one another. It was probably one of the most and harmonious sounds really like utopian and idyllic, but it really was. It was one of the most harmonious like environments that I had been in. And that doesn't mean that there wasn't conflict and chaos, but it felt different. But then I went to grad school. I didn't go immediately to training. I left my school and I went to San Diego, where I studied teaching English to speakers of other languages for 2 years.
Oh, okay. So Montessori was kind of in the back of your mind, but you're not engaging in it on a daily basis.
No, it wasn't in the back of my mind. I was not an education major. I had planned to go to law school.
Oh, wow.
I had really no clue about education. And so me going to grad school was an introduction to education as well as an introduction to this thing that I loved doing while I was in Chile, and then got more exposure to it while I was working as an assistant. Because the thing that I failed to mention is that the school I was working at is a Montessori bilingual public charter school.
So were you speaking English and Spanish to the children, or were you the English teacher?
When I was working at the school in DC, I actually got brought into the classroom Montessori speaking as the afternoon English person. They lost their person who was doing the English component of the curriculum, and they were like, "We'll show you what you need to do." But like, you know, you're not just doing language, right? Because you have no control over when children bring out like the binomial cube or, you know, something like that where you have to engage. And so I wanted to do it, but I felt like I wanted and needed to know more about education. And I most definitely wanted and needed to know more about this world of bilingual education, dual language immersion, that I took as an online course in order to get me to Chile, which was like not enough in the least bit.
So after grad school, where did life take you?
I graduated, I think like May 2009. June, I was in training.
Wow. Did you do training in San Diego?
No, I did training at the Institute for Advanced Montessori Studies at the Barry School in Silver Spring, Maryland.
I love hearing people's Montessori origin stories because I, you know, also came to Montessori as an adult, didn't know anything about it when I was a child or growing up. And it's always fascinating to me what draws people in about Montessori. So did you do training for early childhood or elementary?
So I'm early childhood trained. I would love to do elementary 1 and 2. I would also love to do infant toddler. And I would love to do the administration training just because I'm curious as to what is there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I often think I would love to do the infant toddler training, not necessarily to ever work in an infant toddler environment, but to have that continuity of understanding from 0 to 6, because I'm 3 to 6 trained. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to see a few different infant toddler environments, and I've been blown away. And they've never been in the context of the United States, or rather, I should say, they've never been in Western centric contexts. I've seen an indigenous infant toddler room, and I used to go in and observe my teachers in Shanghai in our infant and toddler classroom.
Wow. So that transitions nicely into my question about your experiences living and teaching abroad. What can you tell us about those experiences?
So I will say it's not just living and teaching abroad, because what I do try to do every time I go somewhere is also see what an education system is like. Sometimes I can actually go inside of schools and classrooms. Sometimes I am just an observer from far away, appreciating that education exists in places where I've been. To that end, I've seen Montessori on every continent except Antarctica. And the most fascinating was in India, seeing the movable alphabet in Gujarati, and being at a school where children who would not have access to Montessori were able to go, and just a really beautiful place, Acima Montessori.
Wow.
But to answer your question about living and working in another country, China was the longest, 4 years. I still miss it dearly. Learned a lot about the power of Montessori in that context, largely because, I'm trying to say this in a way where your podcast can get played anywhere and where neither of us get banned anywhere. What Montessori is politically and ideologically, is in contrast to the trajectory that China has been on for quite some time. So to be able to have grandmas and grandpas specifically talk about how much their grandchildren changed and how much they even changed, knowing that that's never my goal when I go into a country. I'm not trying to change you or call anything that you have or do culturally inferior. But we do know that in Montessori, transformation occurs. However that transformation occurs, we don't know what that looks like, but we do know transformation is there. And it was a beautiful thing to see transformation in a completely different cultural context, where I was definitely able to see transformation over time. And I had the privilege and the honor, to work with Montessorians who were from South Africa, Malaysia, Ukraine, the Philippines, Taiwan, all under the umbrella of Montessori education.
So nowadays, what role does languages and multilingualism play in your life?
Oh, so talking about transformation, right? Transformation for me also means growth, because when I first started my master's in TESOL, which I don't even call TESOL anymore. teaching, I now call it teaching English to speakers of additional languages, because that other automatically others, right? So I've done a lot of learning and unlearning in that process of what I was perpetuating in terms of linguistic supremacy and hierarchy, and what I don't want to be a part of as it pertains to that. So language for me is always and will always be a beautiful thing. I try to make it so that other folks that I talk to, because when folks find out that I have had these travel and living experiences abroad, especially as it relates to English, they want to know like what they need to do. And the first thing that I make sure that I talk about is like, you're not going there to make somebody's English better. You're not going there to try to make somebody sound like you. Like, don't, as nicely or as gently, but as truthfully as you can, anytime someone tries to give that message to you, oh, I want to sound like you, or excuse me, my English isn't good. Like, your responsibility in my eyes is to like shut that down. It's to let them know how much value they bring to the game.
How have people responded to that in the past?
Some people don't get it. Some people just really don't get it. Because English has been given so much power. And for the people who do get it, just like myself, still, they find themselves, I believe, caught in this place of tension of not wanting to stop the thing because the relationships, the connection, what you are able to do is necessary and important. But then you're teetering, or you're trying to figure out how to navigate this when all of your materials speak to linguistic hierarchy, when all types of communication speak to linguistic hierarchy. And when I say that, I mean like coming from your boss or coming from other people who are in the language community, who haven't had light bulb moments or may never have light bulb moments of what teaching English as quote unquote another language, or teaching English speakers of another language, like what that does, what that means.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It is reminding me of when I was in Sicily. This was about 12 years ago, so I don't know if the perception of English has changed since then, but I was working with high schoolers as an English teacher, but not their primary English teacher. I was kind of like the fun teacher that popped in to a bunch of classes once a week. And some of them would say, oh, well, you speak American, you don't speak English, because all of their teaching materials were British. And even those perpetuated this idea of English hierarchy. So British English was the gold standard. And if you were learning other variations of that, then that wasn't as good. So that was a new experience for me, hearing that perspective and kind of thinking about how to approach that in my work with the students.
And someone from the United States might be totally flabbergasted and or offended by that. Because we get so, or we're so focused on the fact that we are the best. Therefore, like, even as we speak is the best. And how could the British, who sound like funny to us, like, how could they be the best? And so what you really get is like this Western ping pong or volley for continuous power. Right? Because I'm pretty sure like Australia comes into the mix of that as well as other countries that comprise the UK. But that also brings up the point of, right, like when we think about colonized countries, countries that have been colonized by the British, who have English as their first language or who have English as one of their languages, depending on their ability to contribute to the global economy, their English isn't recognized. And people don't even think of those places as English-speaking countries. One of the examples that I give, and it's actually not my own, but people don't think of Jamaica as being an English-speaking country. But it is. However, Jamaicans don't add to that idea of Western-centric values, which essentially boils down to dominant culture values, which essentially boils down to whiteness and normalcy that is created within whiteness.
Mm. Relating this back to Montessori, what are some ways that you see that being perpetuated in Montessori and ways that we can try to fight that, you know, break those patterns and systems?
And again, this is nothing that's my own, but I do want to thank my coworker for bringing this idea back up into my head, because it had been there ever since I had been working on my dissertation. But the idea of cultural humility, number one, is one thing that we can absolutely practice. And I say that because you got Montessori that exists like all over the world. But if you look at just in particular, the language materials that are on shelves, unless they are strictly in the language of that place. And so I'm speaking of bilingual schools, which more than likely, like the language materials are not. Or they're getting to a place where they are. These are all Western materials. There is a scholar, an activist. I have tried to practice his name. He's Kenyan, but I believe it's pronounced Wakyongo. And he talks about decolonizing the mind. And he said that anytime we read in English, it is an act of colonization because English is a colonizing language. And so like the thought that is produced in English is colonizing thought. He talked about, he used to write in English a lot, and it, you know, was spread out across the African continent, but he was like, I was actually perpetuating that. And then he started to write in Swahili, and it became less of a decolonizing thing because he went through these stages where he was talking about, he first started writing in English, but then he was writing in Swahili, but he was thinking in English. And it wasn't even like culturally, contextually within Swahili. And then he like totally transitioned. And so when we look at Montessori materials, and again, I'm saying this because I have had the ability to see some schools, not nearly all of them, of course. But for example, a lot of schools in Beijing, Shanghai, and Qingdao, which make up like a lot of Montessori schools in China, they have Western English materials.
That's interesting. It's such a strong example of the connection between language and how we think about things, how the words that we use both shape and express the cultural values and even how we think about things. So it's not just a direct translation.
In fact, I think some people sometimes think that I'm like trying too hard because Spanish is my second language, and for some things I do say things in Mandarin, but it's because that word in English, it really is not the right fit for it. And if you think about that not being the right fit for whatever word that I want to say or phrase that I want to say, how often are we making things fit? And it's not even appropriate, especially if someone comes from a completely different linguistic reference.
Yeah. What an interesting challenge for bilingual schools to navigate.
Indeed. And that's really all I can say about that. Indeed, because when we look at public schools, one of the things that I do in our teacher residency program is talk about multilingual learners. In fact, at NCMPS, for a while, we used to say ELLs and ESL, and I kept pushing back on it, trying to release that power that we were constantly given to English and devaluing the languages that other children speak, other families speak. And not only in the case of it being an additional language such as Spanish or Portuguese or, you know, whatever the case may be, but we've got a number of varieties of English within the United States.
Yeah.
And we keep devaluing those languages, which also means like we are devaluing people and their heritage.
I'm thinking about this is a little bit of a tangent, but I have a collection of The Little Prince in many different languages, and one of them is Spanglish. And I just love that coffee. I've shown it to some of my friends who grew up in a Spanish English household, and the reaction that they have had in just like seeing a few pages of it has been so emotional. They're like, this is how we speak in my house. And so even something as simple as like seeing a book published in, you know, a regional way of speaking English is so affirming.
A few days ago, it just so happens that I think it's EdWeb. They were presenting a webinar on multilingual learners as well. I get happy that that term is now catching so much traction. And, you know, in a few years, we'll hopefully see a complete shift. But one of the presenters was speaking about translanguaging, which is, you know, what Spanglish is, right? I mean, like, even the fact that, and I'm not necessarily knocking it because I don't know how Spanish speakers or speakers of any language would feel about that lish being added on to like the language that they speak. But if you say translanguaging, it is a much healthier and affirming term because it's just moving between languages versus making it seem like someone is trying to get English, but they're like not so good at it. All of that to say, this webinar talked about this book, and I need to buy it. And it's a children's book. It's called, I think it's called like My Poppy Rides a Motorcycle. And within it, it is essentially what we would call Spanglish, but it is translanguaging. And I loved all of the different ways that the presenter talked about how this affirms people, how like children can aspire someday to even write a book that is written without, you know, these standard conventions, and that has much of their language and much of their heart and much of their story and much of their family involved in it without having to sacrifice.
Yeah. Ah, oh, that's beautiful. I'm gonna have to check out that book, My Poppy Rides a Motorcycle. So shifting gears a little bit, you told us a bit about your work with the National Center for Montessori and the public sector, but I'd love to hear about how you got involved with that organization, what your work involves, and some of the unique challenges that public Montessori programs face.
Sure. I got involved with NCMPS actually first as a participant in one of their course offerings. And this is when they used to offer things in person, because as we all know, the pandemic taught us to think very differently about how we do things. But at the time, I was actually living in China. I had just returned to China from an AMS conference, and a few people that I know kept saying, this coaching program with NCMPS is so great. It's so great. And I was a coach at my school in China at the time. And I told my bosses, like, if you really want me to do this, you got to send me here. And I didn't think they would say yes, but they did. And so I flew back to the U.S. I was in Austin for like all of 2.5 days to take this. And I flew back to China. And I started implementing the things. But then what also wound up happening is I became the academic director at my school in Shanghai, which meant I had all of the Montessori and all of the governance of Montessori. And I had a partner, and she had all of the governance that like required documentation for the Chinese government. So I took everything that I did in that coaching, and in the coaching course, they tell you, like, you know, it's, we understand if you have to do it because like public schools have challenges that they have to deal with. It'd be best if you could like really just be a coach, but we understand that like some folks are in leadership roles that are different from coaching, you know, being a head of school or something like that. So anyway, started applying all of that stuff, but then the pandemic hit. And as we all know, that shut the world down entirely. But NCMPS was looking for folks, and I wound up needing to move back to the US for family reasons. I had been going back and forth on like Zoom and other forms of communication, just trying to see like what possibilities were in terms of working with the center. Long story short, when I moved back to the US, August 2020, a month later, I was working with the center. As I mentioned before, race and equity specialist, instructor, and coach. And so I try to talk about language in all of those different roles because it comes up. Like, it has no other choice but to come up because these are public spaces. And by that, I mean, hot button topics are always special education. And what do we do with our, what I am calling emergent bilinguals, and what schools call, what do we do with our ELLs?
I love the term emergent bilinguals, which I have heard before, and I hope that it is becoming more prevalent because it really shows a faith in the child. Like, we talk about in Montessori, have faith in the child, it really shows your faith that they, your trust in them, that they are emergent bilinguals and that's what they're moving towards.
And they don't have to carry this label of my English isn't good enough, so I need to like receive services or be in this class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really honors that they already speak a language. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I think some of the unique challenges that public Montessori faces, I'll start with the most recent and try to think of like some other ones, but the most recent is most definitely the attack on people's heritage, culture, and identity. As I mentioned, I live in Florida. There are actually a number of public Montessori schools in Florida, just not on the panhandle. And, you know, Florida has its ridiculous don't say gay. And, you know, we have history curriculum being distorted and history being erased. Not to mention the history of indigenous folk who are from what we call the state of Florida, whose history doesn't even like make it into books. And so people being able to navigate what that means and looks like when it comes to, or when the choice is rather, I say something and be truthful, or I lose my job and my livelihood. I was on a call earlier today, and I won't mention the person's name because I believe they will be our keynote for our public Montessori conference in April. But this person said, you know, children, especially middle school and up, and I would even say, you know, elementary, depending on how early children get phones. But these laws are created in Florida, for example, and they don't want teachers to have these conversations. But on a phone, all of these conversations are there anyway, and they are there in ways that don't give full information and that cause children to talk and create stories amongst themselves that are not founded on truth. And then they don't even have anyone to bounce these things that they're reading off of, right? And so like you've got these forming human beings who are just trying to make sense of the world. And what we need to do as adults is allow them to be children and allow them to have this curiosity and allow them to be able to answer these questions so that we're not continuously reinventing history. I don't mean history anew, but like a lot of this stuff has already, we've seen it for generations and it just comes back in different iterations. And to that, you know, it's not only Florida. It's not only Texas. It's other places as well. It is Massachusetts. It is New York. It is California. It is Vermont. It is Washington State. It is Utah. It is Montana. It is all 50 states, you know? It just so happens that Florida is really loud and Texas is just as loud. And the more that we're quiet about it, the more those other states that I mentioned, especially the ones that would consider themselves liberal and progressive, folks who are in those states become just as loud because they thought it was only Florida and Texas. Meanwhile, like they're working behind the scenes and undercover to like make things happen as well. What else in public schools? Money is always a thing, right? Because there's disproportionality in funding. You've got disproportionality in special education referrals, in discipline. And I would say like both of those things happen in public and private, but like private, you have like data that is continuously tracked. Yeah, you've also got gentrification. If anybody is listening, and for you, Gabrielle, I don't know if we talked about this before when we were meeting, but there's a short, I think it's like 14 minutes documentary on YouTube, and it's called A Little Piece of Something. And I talk about this documentary at least once a week. And if you search like A Little Piece of Something 180 Films, it'll come up. And it's about Libertas, which is a Montessori school in Memphis, and where Libertas is located. It was one of the most economically disadvantaged neighborhoods like in Memphis. It was predominantly Black. And the documentary just shows like really beautiful things happening at this school. But one of the things that it mentions doesn't go into like a lot of detail is that folks with means started coming because it's public, it's Montessori, and it's free. And then once you have a school that's doing well in the area, especially for people who can afford it, they can buy the homes, they can push the market into a different direction from what the people in the community can actually afford. And then you get people pushed out.
This also reminds, I haven't watched it, I'm going to, it reminds me of not Montessori, but the podcast, Nice White Parents. Did Absolutely. You listen to that? Yeah. I believe it was, it's been a while since I listened to it, but I believe they were trying to start a dual language program in a public school in Brooklyn.
There is another podcast, two seasons, takes place in New York as well. And it looks at Queens because, you know, Queens is supposed to be the most diverse place on earth. But like, what does diversity mean when you still have a lot of separation? School Colors is what it's called.
Oh, I think I've heard of this. I haven't watched it. Okay, I'm going to take away a list of things to read and watch from this conversation. My favorite. Well, this kind of leads nicely into, I wanted to ask you about your doctorate program in education for social justice. So what made you decide to pursue a PhD and what does the program entail?
So I don't know if I really, there was a very, very small part of me that wanted to pursue a PhD. And I thought I would never be able to do it because of the cost. And I'm telling you now, the cost is a lot. Not only the cost financially, but like the cost that you pay mentally, emotionally, physically. Let's see. What I will say is initially, I always wanted to go into law, as I mentioned before. So this whole aspect of what my PhD program is really no different from what I wanted to do my entire life. My PhD program is titled Education for Social Justice. I thought that I would practice international law. It just so happens that I get to advocate for education domestically and internationally. I decided to do this one because I had been waiting for something that felt right, that seemed right. And my program at the University of San Diego can be done completely online or you can do hybrid. And at the time, I thought I was going to be able to move to San Diego to do my last 2 years, meaning at the time when I applied. But as I said, pandemic, family stuff, et cetera, et cetera. The title speaks for itself to me. Then the founding professor who got that program off of the ground, her name is Dr. Joy Spencer, and she currently teaches at UC Riverside. Dr. Spencer is amazing. And then one of the professors that continues to inspire me that I had in my master's program, she and I, her name is Dr. Serena Molina. She and I would communicate back and forth about me studying, not particularly for this program. But then when that announcement came out for that, I texted her, and I said, I think this is it. I think this is time. And she said, yeah, Jazz, this is the one for you. And I did it. And I will say, and I say this to anyone who knows me, has heard me say this, it's a kick in the face. But I do it because, one, I have a blue passport, which gives me a level of access. With these three letters that add to the alphabet soup, gives me another layer of access. I didn't come from a lot of means, but I've been blessed enough to be afforded with opportunities that make me think and see differently and always want to treat people better than how they have been treated. And to be able to do that with children and with adults, like I get to hit both sides of that spectrum. And that right there is a blessing for sure.
That's amazing. So where in the program are you? How much longer do you have?
How long in a PhD program is a construct?
That's true. I should know better than to ask that question.
Right now, I am completing my application for the IRB process so that I can collect data. Hopefully, I will be able to graduate and be conferred this coming May.
Wow. That's yeah. Very exciting. So speaking of social justice and Montessori, what advice do you have or ideas do you have for Montessori educators who are looking to become more involved with social justice in their work with children?
Support the Montessori for Social Justice conference, whether that be donating, whether that be attending. I mean, I would definitely say attend. Have AMS, AMI, any other conference, make sure that there are a fair number of workshops, seminars, keynotes, plenaries that speak to this notion of social justice in education. Support organizations such as KCLC. So that's the Karis Children's Learning Center. I forget an associate of mine named Brooke LaFlo, who is an indigenous Montessorian as well. And she's starting up a mobile Montessori venture. Support my friend Tatenda Blessing, who has a mobile Montessori venture in Colorado as well. Support Sankofa Montessori in, there's one in Atlanta. They're not related. It's a public Montessori school. Support Sankofa in New Haven, Connecticut. Support the Black Montessori Educator Fund, look up Dr. Aize Sabater, support the Black Montessori Wildflower Fund. Listen when people are talking. Like, don't try to talk and don't try to like question what someone is saying. Like, listen to them because they're giving you their experience. Treat all children like you really believe in them. And when I say really believe in them, we've been socialized to think that children of color perform differently, even if it's not something that we actually value, like the noise is there in the background. So see what you can do. Yes, of course, to check your biases and everything, right? But like, have somebody like call you out on the stuff that you do and don't get offended about it. It might bruise your ego, but like, lean into it. Because I've got friends who took their children out of Montessori because their children were experiencing harm within Montessori. I've got a friend whose son was experiencing harm in Montessori by people who were supposed to be quote unquote woke, whatever that means. Yeah, I think I could go on and on, but like, those are just some places to start. Support embracing equity.
Thank you for shouting out all of those. Well, we've gone in so many wonderful directions today. Thank you for sharing everything. Is there anything else you would like to say before we end?
Let's just be better humans. Like, truthfully, be better humans. Thank you for having me on this podcast.
Thank you for being here. This was a great conversation. Thank you again to Jazz for joining me for this wonderful conversation. A reminder that you can find links to everything Jazz mentions in the show notes, which are linked in the episode description. And be sure to follow the work of the National Center for Montessori in the Public Sector, also linked in the show notes. You can find me on Instagram at multilingual.montessori and on my website at multilingualmontessori.org. You can find links to everything in the episode description. Make sure you're subscribed to the Multilingual Montessori podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating and review on whatever app you're listening through. It helps more people find the show, and I really do read every single one. Another wonderful way to support the podcast is to share it with someone who you think would enjoy it as well. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.